Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. It's not raining, which is a miracle. It's beautiful outside. It's about 100 degrees, but we don't care. Of course, it's nice and wonderful in here, and I have the author of Executive Actions, a presidential thriller here, and this book is outrageous. An assassin bullet changes the course of the presidential election, not by killing Democratic candidate Teddy Lodge, but his wife. Okay, Mrs. First Lady, you better watch out. You never know. Riding wave at the top of popular sympathy, Lodge surges forward as the man to beat for innocent incumbent President Morgan Taylor. And if you think I'm going to give away any more, think again. I am not. Gary Grossman has written for the New York Times, Boston Globe, and the Boston Herald American, and he's covered presidential elections. Too bad you need to cover this past one. So good morning, Gary. I am so excited.
Good morning, Fran. Thanks for having me on. I love it, and it's good to hear that it's hot, but you've got no rain in New York, so that's good today. We're on the West Coast.
Yes,
I'm in L.A.,
okay.
and which is a lot closer today to the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, that's not, I know. I have family there, too, and that's not good, I know. And I worry because we don't want to be close to anywhere near that man. So give our listeners a brief idea of how you decided to create this novel and a little bit about just a brief summary, because we're not giving anything away, people. You want to know what happened, you got to read the book. Sorry.
Thank you. Well, Executive Actions actually started in my mind a number of years ago. My principal job is I'm a TV producer and a documentary TV producer. And I was in New York, and I remember the exact date and the exact meeting, and you'll soon find out why, having a meeting with the History Channel. And someone in the meeting, and my company did a lot of documentaries on the Cold War and Cold War figures and historical figures and feuds. But somebody in the meeting, not me, said, do you think we're running out of history? Now, this was at the History Channel. And I said, no, of course, that would never happen. You never know what's going to happen. Well, the reason I remember that so clearly is that was September 10th, 2001. Well, the next day, of course, was September 11th. And we all know how the world changed in that moment. And 2 days later, I was driving back to Los Angeles with my business partner. We had a company called Weller Grossman Productions then. And we were talking to the History Channel about doing a show on the history of civil defense. And we were on the radio in Los Angeles talking to a CBS News station here about the drive across the country and how suddenly in these small towns that we were going through and passing, people realized that New York City was actually part of the United States, and in their town they were part of the United States and part of the same mood and feeling, which really hadn't existed for years. So I began thinking about a realizing that the plot to bring down the World Trade Center towers had been incubating for at least 7 years since the previous attack on the towers, the unsuccessful attack to bring them down, the explosion in the sub-basement area, the parking area. And I thought, well, what would it take, what kind of plot could go on 10, 20, 30, or 40 years? And I had been doing research already for television on Russian sleeper cell spies. And I thought, ultimately, what's the biggest prize? It's the presidency itself. And in the United States, in the Western world in particular, we make a movie a hit, or we don't, and it's gone. I used to be a rock and roll DJ. If the song didn't chart quickly, it was gone. If a TV show doesn't make it in the ratings, it's gone. Well, to much of the rest of the world, particularly the Middle East, it's like the Crusades were yesterday. The legacy memory is centuries, if not longer. So to have a plot incubating for that long ultimately would not feel that long if somebody was manipulating. And that's where the idea of Executive Actions came from, with a 30, 40-year-old plot that was grown out of what is real and is called the and drop-off institute in Russia, where they train, and if you've watched the Americans on television, you'll know some of this, where they train in those days Russians to pose as Americans. Because if you remember in the 60s and the 70s or in the 1950s, you didn't hear as many foreign accents wherever you were, you know, except maybe in parts of New York and some East Coast cities. But most of the time, it was just American English. It might be Southern accents, it might be New York accents, but you weren't, it wasn't the melting pot feel that we have now. So Russians coming to the United States had to actually learn how to act and sound like Americans, how not to bargain when they went to the supermarket, how to apply for a mortgage, how to do all these kinds of things. And they were trained to be Americans. So I took that notion a little bit further and said, what if the Russians actually planted a sleeper in the United States who would grow up in the U.S. and ultimately could be in a position of power? Now, not giving too much away, happily, as you also said at the beginning, you put somebody in power and you wait 30 years and he can run or she can run for office, where might they end up? And that, in a roundabout way, is how I came up with the idea for executive actions. I will tell you fun story. I didn't tell my wife I was writing a novel because I didn't know if I could really write a novel. So she didn't know. And I would come home after, you know, doing my TV job at night, and I would, you know, help with the kids and read to them, put them asleep, and then I would hit the computer, which was not unusual because I would often carry work home and do that. So for weeks, I was writing this book that she didn't know about. Nobody knew about. Unfortunately, I left a folder out with some research in it. Well, I came home one day, she's at the front door holding the folder and saying, "Gary, do we have a problem?" I said, wait, what are you talking about? She said, "This," and she handed me the folder, and I look at it, and I go, oh, that. No, we don't have a problem. She said, "We need to talk." And I said, no, honey, I'm stuttering. Well, the reason she was concerned, inside the folder were printouts on poisons that can go undiscovered in your body. Rifles good at 1,000 yards. She thought, what's going on?
She's next.
What is he doing? I'm writing a novel here. I couldn't run to the computer fast enough and open it up and show her sections where that was in. Well, she was very relieved.
Oh, my God. She must have been like, oh, my God, am I next?
Exactly. As Paul Harvey used to say, and that's, what is it? That's the story.
Well, I have to tell you, Gary, you should be honored because my husband read your books, and he's going to read Executive Action. Oh, by the way, Cheryl's listening from Partners in Crime that do the best blog tours in the world. She wants
the
book.
They do.
I just thought I'd better tell you. You better
excellent.
Get another one, so she wants to read it. She needs to read it. She said now that she read my review and the whole bunch of other ones. You see, I told you, whatever Fran reads, just take one. I know that. Okay, so Morgan Taylor and his cabinet. Tell us a little bit about this man. By the way, my husband has not read any of my books. Well, maybe that's good. Who knows? I actually put my new book in front of him and said, you know, it's only 147 pages. Read it. Maybe someday. So tell us about Morgan Taylor. Yeah, he won't read my book. I mean, and everybody's
all
telling
right.
me I really did a great job. And I'm going to have a blog tour between September 1st and December 1st for
excellent.
This particular book. With who else but Cheryl and the group of Providence books. Who
and
else would I ask to do it? Because they're the best.
Partners in
so
crime.
Tell us
they're
about
wonderful.
Morgan Taylor and his cabinet members.
Okay.
They're a unique bunch, too.
Thank you. Well, it goes back to my childhood. I grew up, you're in New York City, right? I grew up upstate. Well, I get away saying upstate until somebody really upstate, you know, Buffalo or Binghamton or somebody, you know, calls me out. But I grew up in a town called Hudson, New York, about 2 hours mm-hmm. and 50 minutes up the line. It's become a great arts community in the past 25 years or so. My father worked in law enforcement, and my mother worked in politics. She was ran a campaign for our mayor, Sam Wheeler, and then worked at the New York State Senate and the Assembly, and my dad was a supervising investigator for the New York State Civil Service. So I grew up in a political community. Politics was always talked about, and in those days, my folks and so many people were Republican, but Rockefeller Republicans, really moderate and liberal Republicans with a sense of responsibility and community and giving back and the arts and so many things that, not to get overly political now, that when people are running for office, that's not who they are. But I met Nelson Rockefeller many times. I remember with the 1964 campaign when he was just kind of booed out of the room when he was running for president. Goldwater became the nominee of the Republicans. Johnson was the nominee and ultimately elected president, as we know. So I grew up in that kind of environment where I listened to the shortwave radio, news broadcasts from around the world. As a kid, I was a ham radio operator, talking to people around the world using Morse code. And I was aware, even as a young kid, about politics. So when it came to writing executive actions, I thought, well, who do I want to be the president? A Republican or a Democrat? How do I want that person to act and be? And I came up with an interesting character, I think, in Morgan Taylor, who was a former F-18 fighter pilot for the Navy, shot down in Iraq, and ultimately rescued by another serviceman, an Army intelligence officer, for all intents and purposes, and that's Scott Rourke. We'll talk about Scott in a little bit. Well, Morgan Taylor rises up through the political ranks and ultimately becomes president of the United States. He is a Republican, but he's kind of the Rockefeller Republican with a little hawkish bent because of his military experience. And in the series of books, Executive Actions, Executive Treason, and Executive Command, and a new book that I'm writing now, he becomes even stronger and more hawkish. Even though there's a surprise ending at the end of Executive Actions that kind of takes him out of the picture for a while. So what kind of cabinet members would he have? Again, looking at the period, he had a mixture of smart military folks. He had a mixture of civilian people. And as his chief of staff, Bernie Bernstein, Bernsey, as he's called, he has a contrarian because he always wanted the opposing voice in the room for everyone to hear. And to some extent, Bernsey plays that role so that everyone has to really rely on facts and information and not, you know, go off the, I don't know if it's a purposeful phrase these days, but go off the reservation. Nobody, which I think we see today too often, with people in power just spouting something and creating the mess that everyone has to deal with immediately. That's not what Morgan Taylor wanted. He was very, very methodical. So who is Morgan Taylor? He's the president that I wish we would always have.
Well, unfortunately, we don't. It's so sad.
No, we do not. No.
I know. But I really think that I'm surprised that any president, I thought they weren't allowed to have cell phones or phones. I thought they had to rely on other people, no less to tweet immature tweets. And that's all I'll say about that. people don't realize that everything goes all over the world, and everybody in the whole world sees what you write, despite what you think. So you have to be careful with your words, no matter where you write them.
Absolutely, you have to. She was right.
Yeah.
You have
she
to
was.
Measure what you say. You have to think before you speak.
Mm-hmm.
I always joke that I have no filter because I will just kind of speak. Often that I'll say that in a matter of joking, but when it comes down to saying something serious, I do think about what I'm saying, because once it's out there, it's gone. I write for a magazine called Media Ethics, and my most recent article came out a few months ago was what will the word privacy exist in 10 years,
mm-hmm.
in 2025, because there's a generation of people who, you know, willingly give it up. We give it up every, you know, time we buy something on the internet because
mm-hmm.
of the metadata that's you know, gleaned from our choices. And yet we'll worry about if the government is doing surveillance, and yet, you know, look what we give up to Amazon and, you know, and other
mm-hmm.
portals and Netflix and, you know, whatever we watch now. Well, the privacy exists even less when on Facebook everybody is putting their status out there and tweeting, and we again going back to tweets. What you're saying matters. What you write matters. Who you
mm-hmm.
hurt matters. Who you threaten
sure.
matters. And it doesn't go away. It's the, you know what surprises me these days in politics? And I think all of this weaves through executive actions in one
yeah.
way or another. But when somebody does say something, the impact of that is often incalculable. So you have to think about what it is you're saying. And the president, and there are things that you do that you don't even want the public to know, so you don't even hint about it.
Mm-hmm. I know, I agree with you. And I think that maybe he needs to rethink that he's not on a television program, because being the president matters. It bothers me that so many people, as it's going to tell in the book too, write things about the president, whether they're deserved or not. He's still the president of the United States. So I don't know whether that makes us as people look even worse. And the countries around the world are going like, oh, my God. And then what I understand, the Canadian prime minister stepped up to see if he could straighten this out with Korea. But you've got two very controversial characters in this book. One is Teddy Lodge, and one is Jeff Newman. Tell us a little about these two. I didn't like them.
Well, Teddy Lodge, I'm hoping executive actions readers will start liking Teddy Lodge in the beginning, because a lot
mm-hmm.
happens that then they get to where you are, Fran, and you don't
mm-hmm.
like him because of a set of circumstances. Teddy Lodge
mm-hmm.
is a Vermont congressman who is running for the presidency of the United States. He's popular. He kind of looks and sounds like one of the Kennedys to some extent. The name Lodge is an old Massachusetts political name, although he's not related in any way to Henry Cabot Lodge. He's from Massachusetts, originally Marblehead, Massachusetts. He has an accident when he's a skiing accident when he's a young boy, takes him out of school for a couple of years. He comes back. A lot of his friends have, you know, passed him by, grown up. He has to develop a new group of friends. And one of them is a young man named Jeff Newman. Now, by the way, I did not
mm-hmm.
even realize when I chose the name Newman what
mm-hmm.
the meaning of the word was. And I may be hinting at something here, but I was, you know, looking for a name, and I came up with it. And it ultimately really fits him because of Teddy Lodge's story and Jeff Newman's story. We, through the course of the book, need to find out more about them. Teddy Lodge runs for president and is, he's running for the nomination of the presidency as a Democrat, but he's running behind someone else, the governor of Montana. He's running behind him, and he's not going to be able to beat him, most likely. He just doesn't have the bona fides, but he's a very, very attractive candidate. And as you read in the beginning, this is the first secret, probably the only secret that we'll give away, because it's play on, you know, on the back of the book. But at a rally in my hometown, Hudson, New York, Teddy Lodge is about to speak and begins speaking and, you know, bringing the crowd up to a roar, and an assassin in a hotel, a real hotel that's there, the St. Charles Hotel, is taking aim. He's got Lodge in his scope, and Lodge is gesturing and moving, and the assassin fires, and he misses Teddy Lodge. Well, I say he doesn't hit Teddy Lodge. He ends up killing Teddy Lodge's wife. Well, aside from the fact of that tragedy, it propels Teddy even more into the news, gives him a wave of sympathy, and he becomes the Democratic candidate running against Morgan Taylor.
Yeah, I know. So I'm wondering, that could happen in like we saw in our last election, that someone that is not a front runner all of a sudden wins the nomination by storm. And
isn't that something?
Pretty much what happened in our presidential election, and I guess it could happen in any kind of election if you know how to do this the right way.
Well, and as a writer, and as you know, and as listeners will know who write or are interested in writing, once you start thinking the unthinkable, you realize what's really plausible. You come up with an idea and say, this can't really happen. And then when you start connecting the dots and figuring out how you're going to write about it, you realize this really can happen. A couple of, about 6 months ago, working on a new novel in the executive series, and I decided to have the bad guy, the supreme leader of the People's Democratic Republic of Korea, North Korea. And in the course of that, I have him manipulating and doing assassinations. Well, a month later, he assassinates his own brother in real life.
Yeah, I know.
So you start thinking about things. In fact, my first editor, wonderful publisher in New York, president of different publishing houses over the years, Roger Cooper, said, Gary, you're really scaring me, because whenever you're writing about in your books, it ends up happening. And not that everything in executive actions has happened, but exactly as you've said, somebody emerges from a campaign who you think, there's no way. But that something that happens creates that sheer force and wave that takes over, and look who we have.
I know. So what happens when Taylor realizes he might lose the election?
Well, Taylor does realize he can lose the election, but at the same time, I'll introduce this new character to the conversation, Scott Rourke. Scott Rourke is a Secret Service agent. He is the man, in fact, who had saved Morgan Taylor's life in the desert when Taylor's plane went down. And he's a sharp guy, street kid from California, saved from the dark side by a policeman, sent to Taekwondo, a master, helped change his life, graduated from high school, got involved in law enforcement, went into the military, and is patriotic, smart as a whip, and he works for President Taylor as a Secret Service agent under a special designation. I think I called it 1600 designation 1600 for 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He was not one of those Secret Service agents who are around the president. He really is virtually a special investigator. So he, with great relationships in the FBI, great relationships in the CIA, great relationships in the NSA, because those are the people also he came up with in the military. Scott Rourke is not James Bond, and I love James Bond, and I love many of the heroes of many of the thriller writers who do these incredible things, and they pull it all together themselves, and then they go out and they just do it. Growing up, again, in law enforcement family and a political family, I learned that it's not one person. It's what one person knows who shares it with another person, and then they find out that a third person has another piece of the puzzle and a fourth person has another piece of the puzzle. That's how things really happen. That, to some extent, is what did not happen prior to 9/11, when some people knew some things and other people didn't talk to others, or others didn't listen to what they had. And there are names that we could place in, you know, each of those. But it is what affected or contributed to the attack. So Scott Rourke is out there investigating, and he, little piece by piece, starts being suspicious about how the election is going and how the campaign is going, and is there more at play than meets the eye. So he, in Boston, at a law firm, meets this wonderful character, Katie Kessler, who is a young attorney at this law firm, junior attorney, and he takes a shining to her, and she to him, making certain files available, realizing that maybe there's something important, since people, clients of the firm are not her clients. She felt, well, you know, I can't show you anything, but maybe here's where the boxes are that you can look. And they begin developing a relationship. Scott Rourke begins his investigation, which takes him to Marblehead, which takes him to Vermont, which takes him across the country, and ultimately to Hudson, New York, again, my hometown. You write about what you know, and that's what I did. And he begins investigating Jennifer Lodge's death. And there in that town is video footage of the shooting itself, shot by a cameraman, Chuck Wheaton. Well, who's Chuck Wheaton? Chuck Wheaton is based on a friend of mine, Lance Wheeler, who does just that. Lance Wheeler was the son of the mayor, by the way, that my mother was the campaign manager for. So I have real, virtually real people doing real things that they really do, but now fictionalized in this book. And in the footage, ultimately, Scott keeps looking, looking, and looking, and he sees something, which goes back to one of my favorite political movies. I love political movies. I don't know if you remember or have seen, if listeners have, the movie Z, the letter Z, Costas Gravis. It came out in the late 60s. It's about a Greek military conspiracy. And based on an actual story, Jean-Louis Trintignant plays an investigator who works for the government but listens to the testimony of military people who were involved in the conspiracy, and he keeps hearing in this conspiracy people using the same phrase to describe something. That phrase is lithe like a tiger. General uses it. The chief of police uses it. The guy on the street who presumably saw something uses it. And when he hears it for the fourth time or so, even the guy taking transcription stops, because they both know this is a conspiracy. I'm not quite exactly that dead on in executive actions, but Scott Rourke does see something in the video, and it makes him realize there's more to this. He reports it to the president, and the question is, what can they do without real hard evidence? Can they help shake up the personalities, make them make a mistake somehow, or do something wrong? In fact, that's probably the last third of the book.
That is very true, but we're not going to tell them how. We're not going to tell them who killed
them. No, it's executive actions. Please read it, though. It's exciting and very timely for today, too, because the political machinations
bear
such similarity.
I really couldn't put it down. And you are responsible for my eye strain that day. Seriously.
I read three books last night.
And I don't know why I did. I read three books last night. And I was like bored. Television just bores me sometimes. There's nothing on that I really want to watch. So there's nothing like, you know, a really good political thriller. I read a memoir that it grew on me. And I read a phenomenal book called Sons of My Fathers by Michael Simpson. It's a real story about the Civil War and the Vietnam War. So that was like 7,000 million pages. And I'm going, okay, now I've got to read. And I reread part of your book just to make sure that I had it in my head. So there's another plot in this book which really got me going. Who is Fadi Karazi and his brother? And why are they not friends? And I've read books about Libya. And, God, those poor people. How do they deal with this, and why doesn't the government care about them? That's so sad.
Well, thanks for asking. We're getting into an area of the book that takes place simultaneously and is also key to the investigation, which Scott Rourke ends up getting information from. And, in fact, it at one point goes to Libya with a CIA agent to collect data. I'll go back to 2001 again. And 2002, 2003, 2004, there were, of course, Saddam Hussein, we know, in Iraq. He had two sons, Uday and Qusay Hussein, really bad guys, who were competing with one another, competing for their father's position, ultimately, to take over, probably would have killed one another if they could, competitive, wealth, power, had everything, wanted more. And I thought, you know, as I was thinking things through, these kinds of characters have to exist in other countries as well. Well, lo and behold, as I did research, they existed too. Gaddafi had two sons who similarly were competing with one another and would have done the same thing. Mm. So when I was ultimately writing, I thought, okay, I don't want to do Iraq because we have no idea what's going to be happening here in the future. But Libya, Gaddafi will go down, did go down, and why don't I do an administration one or two periods after whatever happens, but also set up that same kind of dynamic. So the two brothers are competing with one another in the way that Uday and Qusay did, in the way that Gaddafi's sons did, and they are all about power grabbing. Now, one of them is smarter than the other, and one of them doesn't keep really a tight lid on the files that he has control over. Not really a spoiler alert, but the plot that began in Russia that we talked about from the Andropov Institute and managing the sleeper in the United States or sleeper spies after the fall of the Soviet Union, talking about what happens in the book, the plot was actually taken over by somebody else, by a figure in the Middle East. And the files and the knowledge of all this kind of go back to what's being held in Libya. So how do we get that out? Well, it requires our own sleeper in Libya. And that is a guy who's came up through the ranks of the FBI. He was trained and is from Detroit, speaks Arabic, and he accepts the position by the head of the FBI to go to Libya, and he takes on a new name, Sami Ben Ali, and he's the one who, at great risk, finds mm-hmm. out what information is there. So I love political movies and international intrigue movies, and I mentioned Z before. I like to write filmically. I like to write multiple things happening at multiple times. So now these days I'm maybe writing a little quicker and a little less dense than I used to, because, you know, we all want a quicker pace on things. But what's happening in Libya is the same time that things are happening in the United States.
It's sad.
They have relationship. So, yeah. So
all I know is that I had an author that did write something about Libya, and at the end of the show, she asked me, and I did, and I don't think she wrote anything else. I sent about $500 worth of clothes and books to Libya, to her, to help her,
good
to help
you.
People there, and to help her. Yeah, I did. And
well,
as a matter of fact,
so
and the porter in my building, Rich, who I love more than anything, can't wait for him to come back from vacation on Sunday. He comes from Ghana, and I give him books and clothes also to send to his country, because they don't get the bestsellers there, he says, and they love me because they get to read everything that I read, and he sends it, and I feel so bad because it's so expensive, but he said it. He appreciates the fact that I do that. And I think that more people need to understand that not everybody has the advantages of getting to read all the clothes that we do, and to send something over there. It was important to me. And I'm sorry. And it was a true story about what she went through. It was horrible. Oh, my God.
Under Gaddafi?
We have another character that is really scary. His name is Waleed. And what role does he play? And there are a lot of people that weren't who they said they were. A lot of double agents. And I'm going to have to do a panel show on this also. I'm doing a panel show on November 9th with a really unbelievable panel. We're talking about crime scene investigation, forensic evidence, and how you would take all of that and present it to a court. And for
mm-hmm.
that, I've got the number one forensic person in the universe, D.P. Lyle. I've got
fabulous.
FBI agent Michael Tabman. I've got Bruce Coffin, who's a police detective. And I have my favorite lawyer in the whole world, Larry Thompson. And they're going to be talking about that. But I think maybe I'm going to ask you and a few others to do one on double agents and spies and how you incorporate them in your writing, because I don't write this kind of stuff. I write horror, and this is interesting because I've been reading so many books like yours, and how many of them are written incorrectly. And the crime scenes are corrupted, so I get like, okay, I want people to understand how to do this. So who is Waleed? I don't like him either.
Well, he's someone definitely not to like, because he works for one of the brothers, presumably,
mm-hmm.
but he's actually a spy for the other brother. So it gets to, is in Libya, so it gets to the duplicity. I mean, again, I'll bring it to today. Look at the leaks that come out of the White House these days and out of the State Department for any number of reasons. The State Department leaks are because they don't like perhaps what the president is saying or doing, so they make a leak. The people in the White House who work for the president, they're making leaks. Some of the leaks may be because they don't like a guy. Some of it could be because they have their own power
mm-hmm.
game going on. Sometimes it's been suggested that the leaker is, in fact, President Trump himself in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in that world of duplicity where there are the core of executive actions is there's a sleeper in the United States, well, what about where the rest of the story is taking place in Libya,
mm-hmm.
where you have two brothers, they don't trust each other. Wouldn't they also try to infiltrate each of their own operations to find out what they're doing so they
mm-hmm.
can play this game of three-dimensional chess and, when necessary, turn it into a deadly game of three-dimensional chess? And that's who Waleed is, Waleed Abdul Latif. He is a spy that the younger brother doesn't know works for the older brother, but thinks is loyal to the younger brother. But he's also, you know, not so efficient that he doesn't take cigarette breaks, mm-hmm. doesn't go out, doesn't leave computers open, and that's where, and I mentioned before, Sami Ben Ali, our FBI agent undercover, will actually get the information that the Americans need.
They're it's scary because the minute you put something anywhere, they see it. I mean, I know my AOL email was hacked. Somebody told me, and I took care of that. And I told them, too. It could happen, and that's why I said before, when you put something on Facebook or anything, and I think teenagers need to know this and young adults, that I was on Channel 5 on Good Day, that your resume is Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, and Instagram.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, absolutely.
I know it from personal experience. They look at that first to see what you write, and a lot of people don't realize you're not going to get hired if you write all the wrong things, and you've got to be careful. So we've got president, and what is operation? The president created, and who would be involved in this, and why is that reporter, Michael O'Connell, involved? He was a good character.
Oh, thank you. Well, Michael O'Connell is... I'm glad because I kind of was Michael O'Connell. I wrote for the Boston Globe, the Boston then Herald American. The mm-hmm. first freelance article I ever wrote was for the New York Times. I worked for NBC News. So I thought, I've got to put a reporter in here. And then I decided, and it goes right back to the beginning of the book, I'm going to tell the story, elements of the story, through news. And it starts off with a segment of the now-gone McLaughlin report where they're debating the presidential election. And at various times, I have characters on the news moving the story along or being interviewed. There's a Meet the Press, and there's O'Connell's reporting for the New York Times. Again, it comes down to, it's not a James Bond book. It's a book about multiple people knowing different parts of the story and finding more about it. And ultimately, the reporter, as we now know happens a lot, they're brought into the White House. And they can do an interview, but at the same time, while they're doing an interview, the president could be finding out what they know. And using, trying to get that information. So the reporter, I'm explaining something a little differently now. Sometimes the characters know more than the reader, and sometimes the reader knows more than individual characters. So O'Connell gives us a chance for the readers to know more than maybe even Scott Rourke, the lead character, knows, and it gives the reader a chance to say, Scott, why don't you turn there? Go left. Open that book. You'll find this where we already know, because Michael O'Connell or someone else has found something. And in other cases, the character will know something, and I'll stop the chapter and move on to something else, and that's a teaser for, okay, you got to keep reading and find out what he or she knows. So he gave me a chance to invest myself in the book as a researcher and a reporter, and to begin to unravel things and to ask questions publicly that somebody doing a investigation under the radar is not able to ask. I have to tell you one thing, though. And you've probably heard this from other writers. The magical part about writing, it's insane. I don't really do the writing. I take dictation from the characters. It's like a Twilight Zone episode. It gets to a point where I'll create a character, work on a character, and then they'll sit down next to me and say, oh, I wouldn't do that. Or, and I'm saying figuratively, they would sit down, I wouldn't do that. Hey, let's go here. Or sometimes there's literally a knock at the door, on my front door, and I'll go, and it's a brand new character. It's somebody who introduces herself or himself into a scene because they were needed. And I guess that's imagination and it's invention, but it's the fun part of writing because as I'm doing it, and I have an outline to some extent,
mm-hmm.
but the deeper I go and the more that I write, I realize it's the characters who are telling the story, and I get excited about what they're going to find. I think Rod Serling probably influenced me early on.
I love The Twilight Zone. It's scary. Oh, my God. There are so many reruns of that, and you just once you said started, oh, my God, this was how he thought of that. Oh, that
such
is too
smart
scary
writing.
For me.
There's a Mexican yeah. restaurant not far from where I live, El Coyote. And I don't write at restaurants, but sometimes I'll rewrite at restaurants, take my laptop
mm-hmm.
over.
Mm-hmm.
There are too many people screenwriting, particularly in L.A., who are writing their screenplays at Starbucks and stuff.
Mm.
But one day I was over at El Coyote, and another person, also with a laptop open, said, "Do you know who used to do this here?" And it was well before the days of computers and laptops. I said, "No, who?" And he said, "Rod Serling used to come here at lunch and write." And I thought,
oh, wow.
That's great.
I would have loved to have met Alfred Hitchcock. My mother used to, they didn't let me watch too much television. I was busy reading 10 books a week, seriously. They didn't let me. But ever so often, I would sneak in and go, oh, my God, that's so good, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And they're on now. They're on one of the stations on the Internet. And we're like, oh, this is so cool. But before I forget, because I don't want to forget, on
okay.
the 15th next week, Bring Her Home, David Bell is going to take center stage. That book was unreal. And then this is a true story. The author asked me to read it, and I was really touched. It was a true story about her son, Joshua, who committed suicide. He had bipolar disease. And Rachel House is going to be here on the 17th to talk about the book, If We Both Don't Cry, in the middle of everything, because it was really sad. On the 21st, another one of Partners in Crime's unbelievable authors, we've got The Church of the Holy Child and by Patricia Hale. That was a really pleasant surprise, that book. I couldn't put it down. It's another Day of Eye Strain. And we've got All Signs Point to Murder on the 23rd. And a really scary book for those of you having children and harvesting and stuff, Dark Harvest on 8/29. And that's just some. Of course, if you want to know what to buy from Amazon, get a couple of thousand books of Executive Action, because Labor Day is good and you go to parties and you can hand them out. No, seriously. And another book by Rachel Hawk, who sent it to me herself, The Writing Desk, fantastic, and Sons of Our Fathers by Michael Simpson. So, before we run out of time in about 10 minutes or 12 or whatever I decide to do, tell us the origin of the 14th Amendment and what happens if the president can't take office or the vice president. What happens then?
Great question, and certainly, again, important to today and discussion of the president, and people should become aware because we never know. And again, if you start writing the unthinkable, it really can become it may be the unknowable, and then it could become the actual. There are two amendments that I do deal with in executive actions. One is the 14th Amendment and one is the 25th. But first, you're absolutely right. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution states essentially that no person, no senator, representative in Congress, or president or vice president can or hold office having previously at any point been proven to been engaged in an insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or given, and these are the exact words, given, and they may be familiar to people, or given aid or comfort to the enemies therein. So, what does that mean? If you're a president, a senator, a vice president, and again, I won't give too much away, but somebody running, we know in executive actions, we're talking about a presidential campaign, if somebody had somehow been or is involved in a rebellion or what could be termed as a rebellion or an insurrection, or given aid or comfort to the enemies, and who would the enemies be, that person, if in office, can be removed from that office. What can the investigation that Scott Rourke is involved in find? Is somebody giving aid or comfort to the enemy? Is somebody in a political position already? How do I prove it? Can I prove it? Can I prove it in time that it will make a difference? Or will time run out if I can't prove it before something even bigger happens? That's where the 14th Amendment plays in. And I had a wonderful constitutional advisor for executive actions who really, really helped me out. A Washington, D.C. attorney, and I could not have, understood it as effectively had I not had an expert in that area, military experts as well. One of my oldest friends, Bruce Coons, involved in Army intelligence for years. He helped me through the military things, State Department. I had people in the White House. But the Constitution, I'm not a lawyer, and the Constitution can be thick and dense, and if you're going to write constitutional law into a book, you have to break it down and understand how it will, what kind of impact it will have. And likewise, the 25th Amendment, which we're all very familiar with these days, and that is the succession. If whoever is president dies, or for some reason can't stay in office, or is removed from office for health reasons, or any other reasons, including the 14th Amendment, then what is the succession? Currently, it's the vice president, and then the Speaker of the House, and then the president pro tem of the Senate. Now, what's interesting in those cases is that, say, the president is removed, the vice president is of the same party that the president was. But what if the Speaker of the House is a different party member? Suddenly, a unelected president who does not represent the party that was elected into the White House, quote unquote, the will of the people, is now president. Where can that be? And that's a heck of an interesting scenario to deal with in a novel.
Yeah, that bothers me, because what happens if the vice president is just as toxic as the president? And
well,
basically they
precisely
can't remove both of them at the same time. And that's even scarier.
It
and
sure
it's happened
is
before, as we know. So
and
we've got about 7 minutes.
Okay.
Looking at it now.
And we're looking at all those kinds of real possibilities. I describe executive actions and the sequels, executive treason and executive command, and a new one that I'm working on. I describe them as political reality thrillers, because they're political thrillers, but they really are just on either the edge of being real, or they're actually real, or what I'm writing as fiction could become real. So I call them political reality thrillers. And not reality in the way that reality TV is reality. It's not real.
I know what you're saying.
Television, it's not real.
So the ending of the book, going forward, because it's going to have to have, you have to write more about these people. The ending of the book makes me wonder, what is going forward for many of these players? So who's coming back? And you are bringing Scott back, because he has to come back. And is there another chapter for the main characters in this president? So what's next? And, of course, when am I getting it?
Great question. And I will send it to you. I'll get, off air. Let me get your address, and I'll send it. And I encourage everyone to pick up the sequel, which is out, Executive Treason. It deals with another threat, and that is, and here we are talking on radio and internet radio and having a conversation, it deals with the power of hate radio. and how these hate radio announcers, personalities, could, if they gave an order out to the country, and they're enough, they have enough minions and followers, in one day they could do such damage and danger. They pose such a threat because of their power, television personalities and radio personalities. And it goes back to the 1930s with a character named Father Coughlin, who was so much against FDR and ultimately basically got drummed off the airwaves, but he was so powerful. So, Scott Rourke continues. I won't necessarily say who the president is at the beginning of executive treason because that gives away the end of executive actions. But there's another character who we really haven't talked about, and that is the man who fires the bullet that kills Jennifer Lodge. He is an assassin who is of the power and skill and ability of the French assassin, the Jackal. He's a master of disguises. He's ruthless. And who the heck is he? And I can tell you, while writing Executive Actions, I had no idea who he was. It wasn't until writing Executive Treason that he revealed himself to me and his backstory to me as an American, as a former American soldier, as a soldier who felt he was abandoned, who then has and his unit was abandoned, and has a grudge against the United States, and then decides to become a killer for hire internationally. And he revealed himself in the second book because I didn't know enough about him at the end of the first book to even have Scott Rourke get his principal nemesis. Nor, and again I won't give too much away, is he able to wrap up the plot, the overall plot, to influence the American politics at the highest level. So there's another player who's still out there because it's what happens in real life. I mean, look at what we're talking about in North Korea. You got one regime and another regime and another regime, three generations in the same family, and it just doesn't go away. So I thought, again, in the non-James Bond world, in the real world of trade, spycraft, maybe the victories are small. And you don't wrap up everything in one story. And I didn't. It takes a couple of stories for these characters to really get where they're going or not get where they're going. So I really do encourage Executive Actions first, and then move on to Executive Treason.
While you were telling me that, and I was listening, I emailed you my address and the fact that you're going to have to tell me when you could do an interview for the next one, because you know I'm not going to let up until I get what I want. So I'm terrible.
Great. I'd be thrilled to. And can I mention that, of course, all the books are available on Amazon and Barnes
yes,
and Noble.
Yes, please. I was going to ask
Kobo.
That. Where can we get about get all of them?
All of them through the standard booksellers in print, in Audible, or in ebook. And also, I invite people to check out my website, which is easy to remember. It's my name, GaryGrossman.com, G-A-R-Y, Grossman, G-R-O-S-S-M-A-N, GaryGrossman.com. And it's all there. And I love, if you can reach me through that, I love hearing from readers. And one reader, and I'll tell this real quickly, one reader said, I know you authors do. I know Vince Flynn did this. Other people do it. You create a great woman character, and then you kill her in the second book or in the third book. You get rid of
her. You can't do that.
And this, the reader said, please, put her in a coma if you want. Have her travel around the world. Please don't kill Katie Kessler. And I said, I have never heard a call like that before or an email. You've got it. Katie Kessler is going to stick around. So I just thought that was great. So, we listen. And as you know, thriller writers are accessible. and we love hearing from people, and it you know readers make us better writers, and I'm a fan of others, and I'm going to have to read your books now, Fran. And
I have a problem. I can't read on my computer. That's why I yell at people if they don't send me print right away. And I've passed on a couple of books the last couple of weeks. I'm said, I'm really sorry. I wish I could help you, but I can't read the book. They're printing them out for me. I don't know why. They just said, we want you to review it. I go, are you sure about that? And yeah, people are actually printing out the books. I'm excited because Barry Kerwin's book that I did last week, 66 Metro, oh my God. And he did the research on, because he does deep sea dive. So by the time I finished reading the book, I had to get an oxygen mask from all the diving. He's writing 37 hours, and I really apologize. I said, I'm sorry, I can't do another interview with you or another review. He's printing out the book. Seriously. Anybody that sends me a book in large print gets first. I've got 50 books to review, but you know when I get yours, it's going to go, you know, where? To the top of the pile.
Thank you.
I just received Iris Johansson's book, and Carla Negga's new book looks fantastic. And every book that I've gotten so far, except for a few, are really great. And I have to say that book reviewers can say whatever they want. And I don't write negative reviews, but if I put in a spoiler and the author is, you know, nice, I'll just say, no problem, I'll take it out. But if an author just says, you know, you can't do that, like, don't even think about it. So I want to thank you. This is great. Let me tell you, like I said, my husband thought the book that you gave him, it was great. He's not giving it to me. He buried it somewhere and said, you're not getting it. I would also like to tell everybody, A Daughter's Promise is out. That's my book. To open the point of view of my mom and myself, her journey with Alzheimer's. It's to help people that go through this. It's a promise I made, and I can't tell you that everybody would do this, but for 10 years she was home, and I did not put her in a nursing home because I signed a paper that she made me get notarized that said, you're not putting me in a home. And it was probably the most difficult decision I made. And I've had to do it again. I do it the same way because she lived for 10 years, and she had somewhat of a quality of life because I drove her crazy a little bit more, so that was even better. I was allowed. So
you're a great person and a great
Gary, if you want
interviewer.
To give me that, I'm trying. The article that you wrote on privacy, I would love for you to email it to me so I could put it in my magazine, MJ10, which is coming out at the end of the month. MJ was my sister, Marcia Joyce, who died. And I created MJ Network, or MJ 10, the magazine in her memory, because it's her fault that I review books, seriously. And, so if you send it to me, I will send it to Robin Fideli, and I will get it in my magazine in the front, and I'm going to also send her your review to put in there to feature it.
Thank you. And this has been an absolute total pleasure, truly one of the best, most wonderful, thoughtful, detailed interviews I've done, and I really, really appreciate it. Top, you know, you hit the high bar.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I try.
Thank you.
I'll send you my address and send me the dates when you're available for the next one. Thank you, everybody.
Thank
everybody had a great day, and like I said, Christmas and Hanukkah are not too far away. I love Hanukkah presents, and if they're books, it makes it even better. And if you're bored and it's raining, pick up a book and read. Have a nice day, everybody, and bye. Thank you.